Thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Paris Schutz. Ed Burke, the city's longest ever serving alderman, chairman of the Finance Committee, adds one more title to his legacy, convicted felon.
After less than 3 days of deliberations, jurors convict Burke on 13 of 14 corruption charges connected to his attempts to get rich off of official city actions.
Bribery and extortion occurring at the highest levels of Chicago city government.
Prosecutors score nearly a clean sweep on Burke and businessman Charles Quay, but longtime Burke associate Peter Andrews is acquitted. The conviction caps a historic downfall for the man considered the dean of city council, the confirmation that he used his powerful public perch to steer business to his private property tax company.
The loss of a child, this is breaking all of our hearts.
The death of five-year-old Jean Carlos Martinez Rivero brings to light troubling conditions at an overcrowded migrant shelter in Pilsen. This as migrants arrive this week via a chartered plane from Texas. And in sports,
tipped and intercepted.
The Bears' slim playoff hopes now likely extinguished after snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
And now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are our very own Heather Sharon, Alden Lowry of WBEZ, Michael Loria of the Chicago Sun-Times, and Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune. Let's get right into it. A little bit to talk about this week. Ray Long, first off, set the scene for us at the Dirksen Federal Building. What was the tenor like in the courtroom when that verdict was read?
Well, Ed Burke really did not have a whole lot of emotion that he showed, but he had been sitting there kind of with his hands on the table, waiting patiently and maybe checking out his phone, seeing if anything was happening. And then when they started reading the verdicts, he put his head down on his hands and just kind of waited for the rest of the dominoes to fall. Because once they hit that racketeering charge, and that was the big one, it was trouble. Because that comes with a maximum of 20 years. He won't get that probably. But it is a heavy hammer to deal with right before Christmas.
That racketeering charge was the toughest one to prove. A lot of things, right. A lot of boxes have to be checked. Heather Sharon, you were there almost every day. What about his family? What about the folks witnessing this in the courtroom?
Well, really, the biggest reaction we saw was from Ann Burke, the former Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court. After the verdict was read and the jury was filing out, she got up and sort of gave Ed Burke a hug and a kiss and sort of patted his back. While that was happening, Pete Andrews, his longtime aide who had been acquitted on all counts, was sort of celebrating quietly with his attorneys, sort of hugging and you know, handshakes. And you could see a broad smile break out over Ed Burke's face. It was clear that he was pleased to see his longtime friend acquitted. He, in fact, paid for Pete Andrews' defense. He paid almost $200,000, more than that over the last several years. That was money well spent. Not so much for Burke.
Remind us about Pete Andrews' role in this and why you think he was acquitted.
So Pete Andrews has worked in Burke's 14th Ward office for decades, and he was really a functionary. Ed Burke said, make sure this guy gets a permit, make sure that guy doesn't get a permit. And the jury, I think, believed that Pete Andrews didn't understand or didn't know or wasn't a part of the overall scheme to sort of take the owners of the Burger King and extort them to get you know, his private law firm practice hired. There was no direct evidence with Pete saying, yes, I understand that this is a criminal enterprise, unlike we had from Alderman Burke and the other co-defendant, Charles Quay. And I think Pete Andrews' lawyers were very effective in sort of painting him as this, like, sort of a schmuck almost. You know, part-time Pete, they called him, lunch pail Pete. And they really laid it on thick that, you know, Pete didn't have any sort of intent to deceive the FBI agents when they arrived on his door. You know, I think that they gave the jury a way to sort of say, you know, maybe he wasn't involved, and they sent him home.
Certainly an effective defense. Alden Lowry, we've witnessed the George Ryan trial. That took something like 10 days for a jury to come to a verdict. The first Blagojevich trial, 14 days, and then it's a hung jury, 10 days for the second trial. Are you surprised at such a relatively swift verdict here on 14 counts?
No, not really. I mean, going through the case, a lot had been laid out, four different schemes. It seemed pretty clear that, and I think Burke's reputation kind of preceded him coming into this trial.
Although not according to some of the jurors. Many of them, when they were interviewed, said they had never heard of him before.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I wasn't surprised. I thought that in terms of the case that was laid out, I think it was pretty clear. And maybe to my degree, my understanding of how Ed Burke has been and the way politics has happened in Chicago. I think it was an easy conclusion for someone who had a familiarity with that background to make. Think about it. There's a business owner that wants to get something very minor done. Right. Why is there even a conversation about property tax business? Literally, they talked about this being the city was like a criminal enterprise for Burke. Aldermanic prerogative and the way we've done business in Chicago politically, the finance committee chairmanship, there is just too much power in the hands of one person, and we've allowed that set up in Chicago politics. And I'm hoping that in addition to Burke falling, that this paradigm that we've used politically in Chicago also
falls. Right. You mentioned he was powerful chair of the Finance Committee. There was way too much power. He had power over the entire city workers' compensation system. That eventually was taken away from that committee. Just an enormous amount of power that he had, that he wielded, and that he used now, we know, to try and steer business to his own personal property tax firm, which would eventually make him money. Michael Loria, the question that's asked after all these convictions is, have future public officials learned their lesson? Are they going to be a little more careful next
right.
time?
Is this the end of the Chicago way? Yeah. I think obviously the short answer is no. but we'll see. I think Alden kind of hits on a good point, though, regarding aldermanic prerogative. This is something I've been thinking about, too. Obviously, this is a practice that goes back decades and decades, allows council members to veto developments in their ward. It's I've been thinking about it a lot because I cover immigration, and right now we're seeing migrants have a hard time finding housing in the city. This is because we have a shortage of affordable housing. This is, contributed to a lot of the ills in the city. And it's also why, there was this opportunity for corruption here with Ed Burke.
And Ray Long, if you're the defense, really, when you have 14 charges you're going up against, you're not going to get some kind of full acquittal. So right. You're just aiming for at least one juror here. Like, maybe that one's going to hang the whole thing, like they did in the first Blagojevich jury. They didn't even get that.
No, and I think the speed of the verdict also helped. When they left early on Wednesday, they left at 4:30. They usually stay till at least 5 o'clock. I thought maybe they were getting close because they may have just decided, let's go home and sleep on it. And then they came back the next day, went through the final details. And we were told by one juror that they went through all the tapes, and the tapes were what did it. And even U.S. Attorney Morris Pasquale said, it was his words that did him in.
And really, it was Danny Solis,
yes.
His former friend and colleague,
right,
who
right.
recorded those words that did him in. Heather Cerrone, if you look at the reaction from some of both of their current and former colleagues, they seem to be more upset at Solis for being the quote-unquote rat than Burke for doing the deed.
Well, back in 2019 at City Hall, when the news broken by the Sun-Times that Danny Solis had served as a mole, it was an earthquake. People were sobbing. People were, we had one alderman say that, he grew up where you don't snitch on people. You had another alder person say, but we're a family. How could you do this to a family? Just a complete, I think, misunderstanding of what an alder person's role is in the city of Chicago. And I think Alden's point is well taken. This jury verdict should serve not only as the final word on how Ed Burke conducted himself as a public official in Chicago, but it should serve as an indictment of how Chicago has run its government for decades. Ed Burke operated no better than a mob boss, because we did not hear him make explicit threats. We heard him say, oh, now you're going to ask something of me. I mean, that's straight out of
It sounds like
Goodfellas.
Something Mario Puzo could have written in The Godfather. Heather had asked the acting U.S. Attorney Morris Pasquale yesterday, Ed Burke's been around 50 years. Why now? Why did it take this long? I think, again, it was an open secret. All of us that covered city council, all of us that were there day after day knew how Ed Burke operated. He really, and then there was that great article in WBZ showing the 400 sometimes he recused himself from votes because of conflicts of interest. But we know, even though he recused himself, he had an influence on how those votes went. So what took the Fed so long?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's a question. I mean, for years, people talked about, when's the case coming against Mayor Richard M. Daley? And that case never really came. There were some associates very close to the mayor that came. I think, generally speaking, when you're going after the big fish, pun intended perhaps.
The big tuna.
The big tuna. You want to make sure you have all your ducks in a row. You want to make sure, because you may only get one shot at that. And so I think they waited until they felt like they really had the goods. And they had Solis. And so that, I mean, that was a real feather in their cap from a prosecutorial standpoint. So I felt like they finally felt they had the goods.
You mentioned the racketeering charge. Ray Long carries up to 20 years in prison. What do you think prosecutors are going to ask for? Ed Burke is 80 years old. You know, defense attorneys made the case. He's a family man. He's got children, grandchildren.
Right. I think that they will go as high as they can. There'll be some rules that will rein in what they can actually ask for. And if you look historically, another finance chairman going back to the 70s, Tom Keene, who was as powerful, if not more powerful than Burke, got 5 years when he was in when he was jammed up by the feds too. So you got to look and say he doesn't have a criminal past, and that's going to be something that the judge
you
weighs.
Know that they'll get the letters of, you know, what a great guy he is.
Right.
I'm sure some of his former aldermanic colleagues will write in and say, he helped me out on this.
Yeah.
He donated to that charity. He cared for this person.
Right. And there'll be a lot of that going on. And, you know, the hearing may go for a long time, the sentencing hearing, because there'll be a lot of people who will have a lot to say. Burke now, who is known for big speeches, will be having to put together the speech of his life when he goes before the judge.
Do you think that speech, Heather, would include some kind of contrition? We know how hard it was for Rod Blagojevich to offer any contrition whatsoever. And then once he got commuted, you know,
yeah, it's going to be really fascinating to see if he has any sort of self-awareness of sort of how he sort of got himself into this predicament. We did not really hear a robust defense of his character during the defense case or anything along those lines. The closest we got was when his attorney, Joe Duffy, said, you know, he loves his family, he loves his God, and he loves his city, and there's no law against being a self-promoter or trying to get business. And I think if that's his argument to Judge Virginia Kendall, I think that perhaps might not go well for him. But he has been doing this, as I said, for so long. This was a part of who he was, how he operated day in and day out, and how he amassed power that he used to help the people that he was allied with and to hurt the people he saw opposing himself. I don't know how you sort of change that on a dime, even with your liberty at stake.
What is the process here? Sentencing hearing in June?
In June, right.
Does that mean right after that he's put in a jumpsuit and walked off to federal prison?
I mean, in theory, you could do that, but I doubt that that will be the exact time that they'll march him to a prison cell, if that's what they decide.
Every news company is going to have to get their choppers, like they did with Blagojevich. They just followed him right to the fast food restaurant and then right into the jail.
Right. I don't see him going a revolving door from the courthouse right to prison, but I do see him really in jeopardy for going away for some time.
All right, Alden Lowry, it's not just Ed Burke, it's Mike Madigan awaiting his upcoming trial. If you're Mike Madigan right now, how are you feeling about this verdict?
I think it's got to make you a little nervous, especially not just that verdict, but also the verdict in the ComEd 4 trial, the guilty verdicts there. The crosshairs are directly on him. Now, Madigan is kind of throwing a Hail Mary, essentially now, with this impending Supreme Court decision, which could rewrite the federal statute on bribery. I don't know the details about that thing, gratuities and all of that, but if the Supreme Court rules and changes that, it conceivably opens the door for the conviction that has already happened for the ComEd 4, and also potentially would have an impact on whatever might happen with Madigan. Thus, his legal team is pushing for his trial to be pushed back so that that verdict can come in.
Right,
or that
tactic is
can come in.
Delay, delay, delay. All right, well, so much to talk about here. We'll keep talking about it. We do have to move on to the tragic death of the 5-year-old migrant John Carlos Martinez Rivero. After staying for a few weeks at that shelter at 22nd and Halsted that's had all kinds of problems, what do we know about what happened to him exactly?
Yeah, so the Martinez Rivero family got to the shelter November 30th, and John Carlos passed on this past Sunday, December 17th. What we know, you know, I was looking at the police report earlier, and what we know is that in the days leading up to his passing, he was suffering from a fever and also had taken some anti-fever medication. His parents also got some sort of pill the day beforehand from a friend to try and help with that fever. I guess I kind of bring that up for two reasons, really. Not so much because the pill itself, but really because look where his parents were turning to try and get help at that point, right? He had visible symptoms for days and had not seen a doctor. His parents, when instead of, you know, trying to go to...
And yet the city keeps saying that there's health care available to everybody. I mean, everybody gets to go for screening at Cook County Health. There are folks that are supposed to be there staffing that.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. That's what they're saying, and that's what we're trying to get some information on. But if you talk with a lot of folks in shelters, and you know what I'm talking about. If you talk with folks in shelters, a lot of them are not seeing doctors. You know, I've actually talked with doctors in that area who work at clinics where they have to accept uninsured patients. And I think kind of the remarkable thing from those conversations is that these are folks who saw these kids when they first moved into the shelter for routine vaccinations. And then they saw them come back later with illnesses that they did not have the first time.
It's outrageous. I mean, is
the mayor's administration getting a pass here? I mean, do they deserve criticism for... there have been reports of the conditions at this shelter, folks talking about an illness outbreak going on for weeks.
Yeah, I just don't understand why you can't get medical care to people who need it in Chicago, who Chicago is a sanctuary city. If it really wants to walk the walk, then it has to talk the talk, and it has to walk the walk. I may have gotten that back. But I'm like a lot of people, are upset by what is going on here in Chicago. And
I mean, it seems like the conditions at a place like this might be worse than they were at police stations, and they were terrible at police stations.
Right. I think that, you know, the mayor has explicitly promised to provide dignified living conditions for the migrants here. And I think that it behooves all of us to ask whether that is what's happening in the city-run shelters that are being paid for with Chicago taxpayer dollars. Are people being adequately cared for? I mean, I can't imagine... I have kids and being, you know, having a sick kid and having to, you know, nowhere to turn, essentially, which is what happened to this 5-year-old. And, you know, I think it's an indication of how badly the city's social safety net has just been ripped apart by this crisis. And I think, you know, you can make arguments about Texas Governor Greg Abbott and why he's sending them all here and all of that. But, you know, we as a city have a dead 5-year-old, and it's not clear whose fault that was and what steps are being taken to prevent other people from dying.
We had Mayor Johnson on the show a couple nights ago, and I kept asking him, is this place safe? Is this shelter safe for migrants? And he just kept reverting to Greg Abbott. Is the city answering to what's happening here and to how to more humanely address this situation?
I think most of us appreciate where the mayor is going on that. But the bottom line is that when those migrants arrive here, they become our responsibility. And we have said as a city, we accept that responsibility. Just in a way that I think some of the problems with the shelters has been just not truly understanding the gravity, the threat in terms of a health perspective. Think back to COVID in those very initial months and what happened in nursing homes. This notion of this congregate settings, a very, you know, tough illness, and it just spreads like wildfire. And those are the kinds of conditions that this 5-year-old is in and that other migrants are in. And I think the city has to understand now, especially now that there's a life that's been taken, this is really serious business.
Clearly there are buses coming, as Heather reported earlier, there's charter planes coming. I mean, they can't keep up with the load of migrants that are coming here. But Michael Loria, what about this contractor called Favorite Staffing? They're contracted to manage this facility and a few other facilities, a $40 million contract. Yeah. Are they accountable for the conditions here and for what's happening?
I mean, it does kind of seem that way. I think it's important to bear in mind there's 27 shelters. Like, the level of care at each one varies. I'm told with healthcare workers that work in several shelters, you know, some of them are actually, they seem all right, decently run. But this shelter, certainly that doesn't seem to be the case. And in terms of, you know, trying to actually get the care that these folks need instead of pawning it off on Favorite Staffing, who by many accounts, they don't do a lot with in shelters, and you know, in terms of getting them care. Rate makes a great point in terms of the amount of medical care available in the city. You know, when folks were in police stations, there were volunteer medical students and physicians who were going and taking care of them.
They're just as willing to do it here. Like some of these volunteer medical staff were being turned down at this shelter.
Right.
And we don't know if that's favorite staffing or something, saying, no, we have our own people. But it just seems like there's just so many more questions that are unanswered here.
Yeah, there, just the idea, you know, even going back to looking at the idea that they were in police stations on the floor when we have vacant buildings that should be available. There's no creative thinking like, hey, could we offer tax breaks to people who have abandoned buildings but want some break somewhere to help out?
Well, this particular building, if you look at the records, this was bought in August by a company called Farpoint Development, which is developing something near the Michael Reese site. I mean, I wonder if they anticipated that the city was going to use this. But again, don't you have to retrofit the building to make it like suitable for people to stay there? And apparently it's way overcrowded.
Right.
I mean, the reports are there's 2,300 people there.
Yeah, and there should only be 1,000 people in that building.
Right.
And I think when you get that sort of overloaded, there's really no way to keep people safe. And to, as I said before, allow them to live in a dignified manner. And I think that, you know, there's been a lot of debate about whether the city should be paying for these things directly. Should it be the state? Should it be the federal government? The fact of the matter is that, as Alden said, you know, they're here and we have an obligation as a community to care for them. And if people aren't being cared for, and you know, nobody's frozen, isn't freezing outside, well, great, but do we have a greater obligation than that?
Yeah, I think it's thank God that there's not snow coming down here and that there's
rain.
Yeah, if we had to load up sleighs of people like Jane Byrne going down the middle of the street, we would really be in a terrible.
So speaking of they're here now, Heather, now a batch of around 100 migrants arrived via chartered plane that apparently Texas officials had chartered, and then the mayor's office said that the officials then jumped in an Uber and quickly got away. Why are they now sending folks via chartered plane?
Well, the city has cracked down on the way that Texas is sending buses to Chicago. Now, the city has said we have a designated spot for everybody to come to so that people can get off the bus, can get medical care, and be processed and sort of documented in some way. If they don't do that now, if the Texas buses don't do that, they risk thousands of dollars in fines and impound. And Greg Abbott essentially said, I'm not going to play that game. We're going to send buses whenever and wherever we want, and we're not going to abide by their rules. So the Johnson administration has fined 96 buses and has impounded one bus. And that this was Greg Abbott's response to charter a flight from El Paso to Chicago, landed on the private airfield, and then, you know, these people apparently got off the plane, got an Uber, and then left these migrants sort of asking people for help, you know, where should we go?
It's like a game of chess and one-upmanship when you're dealing with people's lives and livelihoods.
It's amazing how poorly this has all been handled. And you can't put all the blame on Mayor Johnson, but you do want to see more leadership in, you know, placing people.
But he does have a point when the Texas governor, they're not communicating with the city. They're just sending buses. Now they're sending planes. They're trying to get around the rules that the city is setting up.
Yeah, I think at the outset of this last year, there was a communication which was essentially, and I think this started with Mayor Lightfoot, you know, can we have a conversation? Can we have some coordination, you know, regardless of what your motivations are for sending migrants here, you know, in interest of their care, can we talk about how best to make this transition happen? And those conversations really have never taken place.
Michael Loria, how many more buses or charter planes do you think city officials are expecting?
I'm not sure. But in terms of buses, you know, a lot of this has been a factor of how many people are crossing the border. And right now we're seeing a lot more folks crossing the border than we were before. So I expect we'll see a lot more charter planes. I don't think we've received any more, but Abbott said he'll continue to do that. I guess we'll have to expect more.
And you know that it'll ramp up once the DNC comes around this summer. We are out of time. Great discussion, everybody. Our thanks to Ray Long, Heather Sharone, Michael Loria, and Alden Lowry. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
That's our show for this Friday night. Don't forget you can get Chicago Tonight and the Week in Review streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news. And on a programming note, we are off Monday for the holiday, but back on Tuesday. And be sure to join us next Friday at this time for a special year in review. And now for the Week in Review, I'm Paris Schutz. Thank you for watching. I hope you all have a wonderful and safe holiday weekend. Enjoy celebrating wherever you may do, and be safe. Have a wonderful night. Alden Lowry, Darnell Mooney, the ball landed right in his hand on that Hail Mary, and he just basically gave it away.
I think he was stunned. Like,
what is this doing here?
Like hot potato. Like, what in the world? Just a real tough break and a microcosm of what the season has been. Yeah. But I still think the Bears are in a great position. They're going to have two high first-round picks.
Are they going to draft a quarterback?
They should not. I think they've got their quarterback. I really do. I mean, it's his third year. The guy has had some electric moments. I think he's starting to kind of figure it out. Your quarterback is the hardest position in sports.
It's a roll of the dice. No matter where you draft, draft the number one, there's no guarantee.
Yeah, and they'd be starting over. We'd have to wait another 3-4 years to figure out if he's got
how many, yes, three years in a row.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its 20 attorneys who have been named in the 2024 edition of the Best Lawyers in America.